Hey listeners, you're tuning in to a podcast about Kids in the Hall that easily veers off into mature subject matter and includes a whole heck of a lot of swearing. Enjoy the show, eh?
Welcome to Kip and Tell, a somewhat functional podcast about the kids in the hall by a bunch of millennials whose wildest dream as children was to spend an afternoon with a gentle Italian man dressed only in a towel. I'm Hans.
Keep the energy up.
I'm Hans Seidemann in Vancouver, BC, and I'm joined today as ever by Kalina McCourtoff in London, England. Hello, Kalina.
Gotta say, I'm feeling fresher than a newly laundered terry cloth.
Good. I'm glad we're all feeling fresh and delightful. That other voice you hear is Stu Derek Kotick in Victoria, Canada. Hi, Stu.
Started my day the best way you can, walking out of a giant box of condoms.
That's how I imagine Paul wakes up every morning. And then also in Vancouver, we have Trevor Record.
I, for one, am still waiting for my fish breakfast.
That's what you do after you get out of the box of condoms as you get out of bed, yeah.
Yeah, it's a 1-2 process.
Yeah,
come on, get it together.
Yeah. And finally, as ever, we also have
Hello,
Paul
and
from Toronto.
Thank you.
Yay!
Thank you so much for inviting me to your little cocktail party online. It's delightful.
For listeners at home, we decided that an occasion of talking to Paul required that we have feather boas, flower lays, tiaras of all kinds. Yes, we're trying to create a welcoming, safe environment for Paul. Somewhere where you might feel at home.
By queening
yeah,
it up.
Exactly, yeah. But that is right, loyal listeners. Today is a very special episode of Kith and Tell because we're joined by the man, the legend, the towel himself, the toweled one himself, I should say, the one and only Paul Bellini. And, we're just, obviously it goes without saying, but we'll say it anyways. We're so thrilled to have you, and we can't wait to pick your brain and through your very clean stack of towels for all the behind the scenes stories about Kids in the Hall and your career outside the show, which is, lengthy enough to be a host on this show, but includes movies, glittering awards shows, TV, queer punk musical acts, and many fabulous costumes, of course. So we wanted to say that we are extremely thrilled to have Paul as our first cast member guest on the show. Since it's because of Paul that this podcast even exists in the first place. And that's because we had all been together at a bit of a friend getaway, and there was hot tubs involved. And at one point, one of our friends emerged from a hot tub, threw on a towel, and struck a pose. And several of us remarked that he looks exactly like Paul Bellini. Stu, you were saying earlier, his hand was positioned kind of...
It was the placement.
The placement of
Well, it was both the placement, but I also remember him just like standing there for a while. Like, yeah, he was just sort of like gazing over his kingdom. And
might have actually even been close to a platter of fish.
So we all started talking about our favorite sketches, and that turned into this podcast.
It's great.
So we owe you a tremendous debt of gratitude.
Thank you. I love being an impetus for great things.
Just think, if it wasn't for you, you wouldn't be here today.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. Thank you, Ken.
In so many ways, in fact, yeah. Beyond just talking about the kids in the hall, we also wanted to get to know yourself a little bit better and how you became the legend that you are today. Starting with your early life in Timmins, Ontario. Relatively small town, as we understand it, a bit of a mining town. Certainly when you were coming up, what was it like for you growing up and being a Paul Bellini in Timmins, Ontario?
Well, you grow up in a small town. Everybody knows you, and they all know your family. So there is no anonymity. And as a little gay kid, my first thought was, I got to get away from these people. But it's not because I didn't like them. I actually have very strong ties to Timmins, even though now most of my relatives are gone. It was a great place to grow up. It felt very much like being in a nostalgic independent movie about the 70s. And what can I tell you? I mean, I was plotting my escape the entire time because I knew I had to leave if I was going to do anything. You can't stay in a town where there's like just like one TV station, one newspaper. It just, it's not big enough for you. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And so in particular, I mean, you come, you're Italian. Mm. You do you have a big Italian family, and how did that play into your kind of feeling like you needed to escape? Were they accepting of you know, young Paul growing up to be who you are?
Well, first of all, if you're talking about me being gay, I didn't come out until like the 90s. So the entire time I was growing up, they might have thought I was peculiar, but not necessarily homosexual. I had a big extended Italian family. My grandmothers and my aunts and uncles all lived within walking distance of our neighborhood. We always got together for big family meals and events and stuff. It was very much community oriented. It was great.
I can understand that dynamic between both feeling very comforted, but also knowing that there are other things.
The thing is, the 70s was what an incredibly explosive and exciting decade, you know, because you had disco, which I love. You had all that edgy filmmaking, the edgy mm-hmm. filmmakers. And the cultural growth. I mean, the beginnings of the gay movement and women's liberation and all these things were happening at the same time, but they weren't happening in Timmins. So I had to go to Toronto to really understand what was happening.
So when you went to Toronto, you went off to York University for film studies. Is that right?
Yeah, I was lucky. My dad worked in a mine and they had these big scholarships. So I got a scholarship and it was great. Covered all my education. I wanted to go to York because they taught film production and film studies. And I figured that would get me right out of Timmins if I was as far away as Toronto. And I learned instantly that I was really bad at film production. I couldn't use a light meter or a sound recording equipment. All my footage was horrible looking. So I switched over to film studies. I was a lot more successful in that regard.
So it was specifically to go for a film, not to just get to Toronto and then figure out the profession later. That was right from the get-go. Well, you were clear you wanted to be involved in sort of film and television.
Yeah, I was in love with movies from when I was a little boy, like 6 or 7. I remember the first movie I watched was Libel with Dirk Bogarde. I was about 8 years old and I was enthralled by the drama. And I knew that this had to be in my future somehow. So the entire time I'm in high school, I'm devouring books on film. And, you know, at that point, none of these things were available. You couldn't just say, oh, I want to see Ivan the Terrible. You'd have to like go to a big city and go to a library and request a print and have it screened on film equipment. You know, so there was none of that access. So we'd read about the movies and get all excited about them. So that was always my plan, was to go to film school.
That was where you ran into who would be a kid, one of the kids in the hall.
So we were, Scott and I were in the same residence together. And he was on a different floor, but a group of us always used to eat in the lunchroom. And we'd sit at a big table. And Scott was very entertaining from the get-go. I mean, he was crazy. And he'd just come back from the Philippines. He'd spent a year in the Philippines. And all his stories were about his travels. And I found them fascinating. Mm. And he was the type of, like, he'd wear costumes to lunch and stuff like that. Nothing stopped him, right? And as a filmmaker, I thought, this is the actor I have to be with. Because the first thing I needed to shoot was a guy falling out of a tree. And Scott said, no problem. Tree and fell. Amazing. And that was
and you're like, the camera's not even on yet.
But that was the beginning of our relationship, was him falling out of that tree.
Did you feel like you had an immediate, you know, connection and affinity to him on a personal level as well?
I think subconsciously both knew that the other was gay. Neither of us came out until after graduation, 4 years later. I think instinctively we knew that we were both crazy in the same way, even though we have very different personalities and body types. And we think very differently in terms of, like, I'm really methodical and exacting and he's more chaotic and you know, always firing away. And that sort of made for really good chemistry. That all came later, though. Initially, I think it was just like, he's crazy. And I got to put crazy on film. So it was a simple thing.
Yeah, so you just mentioned you neither of you kind of came out until after college. So that would have been sometime in the early 80s, I suppose, then?
I think it was probably the summer of 82. Right. I'd heard that Scott was going to gay bars, and I was scandalized. and he had a long talk with my sister about it. And then my sister said, "You're gay, right?" And I said, "Well, actually, more of a," and she just went, "Oh, shut up." And so at that point, I realized that there wasn't much point in being covert anymore. So why the hell not just say it? It was summer of 82. But it wasn't until a full year later. No, it might have been probably summer of 83. I went to a gay bar, me and Scott and a couple of other guys. They took me to my first gay bar.
Wow.
So that was 83. Yeah. You got to remember, AIDS was everywhere all of a sudden. Yeah. And it's like, oh, yeah, you're coming out. Great. You're going to be starting a sex life in this horrible environment where you're likely going to die.
Jesus.
So it was a horrible time. You have no idea.
Mm-hmm. Was it important then for you to have a friend like Scott to kind of blaze a bit of a trail to you know, give you some confidence to come out and do that? Or do you think if, you know, whether you'd met him or not, you still would have been coming out around the same time and you would have been just as terrified, but you still would have done it? Or do you think that helped at all?
Well, obviously I was thinking about being with men throughout my entire university experience. You know, Scott was lucky because two of his high school friends came out at the same time. So it was actually a group of four. And we used to go to all the dance clubs. And, you know, it was a very innocent time with all that thumping music. It was kind of fun. had it not been him, it would have been somebody else.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about some of your other earlier ventures like Mouth Congress and things like that in a little bit here. But you know, flash forward maybe just a little bit, and then Scott finds his way into a little troupe that you might have heard of called Kids in the Hall. And what we're curious about is what your first impressions were upon seeing this act, either before or after Scott was involved. Did you see it and go immediately, oh, these kids have it, this is going to be a hit? Or were you maybe a little bit more skeptical?
Well, it's kind of a pathway. See, Scott was actually trying to get through acting school, but he was very bad at taking direction. so he kind of, I don't think he graduated from theater performance, much like myself. I wasn't in film production, it was film studies. But I think he didn't realize he was a comedian until a little later on when he had joined an improv troupe with some other people, and they were doing some shows, and he kind of liked what he was doing. And then he started his own troupe, and we used to have comedy nights at this place called Harborfront, and you could do improv. And if the audience liked you, they would cheer. And if they didn't, they could throw foam bricks at you. And Scott was the all-time greatest recipient of foam bricks because he did, because he always pushed the audience over the edge, right? And so I would go see him doing this, and I started to meet some of the other comedians. When he joined Kids in the Hall, he had seen them at some special evening. And he could tell you this story himself. It's something about donuts taped under the seat, and he had to throw the donut at them to get their attention. And just, so he decided then and there, I want to be part of this. And I didn't see the kids perform until maybe January 1985, and it was Scott's first show. I'd never really heard. I sort of knew of them, but and I remember the same thing. It was like, I have to be involved in this forever. It was just an immediate connection because they were doing stuff that I literally had never seen before. The comedy I was watching, a lot of it is referential. It would be parodies of existing TV shows or commercials and stuff like that. And they all of a sudden were doing, you know, relationship humor based in the suburbs or strange retail experiences. And everything about it was familiar yet unusual. And it certainly had its impact. I remember one of the first things was Mark McKinney going through a rack of old used clothes in his Nina character. And I thought, this is brilliant. There wasn't even any jokes. It was just pure performance.
that's one of the things we talk about a lot, is that they did drag, but they do very like believable or like very relatable drag, you know?
I don't think they even thought of it as drag until it came time to make a TV show, because when it was the Rivoli shows, you know, when you're on stage, everything's transformative. If I say I'm a goblin, right, then I'm a goblin. but on TV, you have to create a goblin, mm-hmm. right? And I think for them, they were just, because they were character comedians and they were taking from characters that they knew, people in real life, they were drawing on landlords and old school teachers and distant relatives and girlfriends, and they just did it. I don't think they even thought of it as male characters or female mm-hmm. characters, just as characters.
Yeah, and it sounds like the characters that they were doing really resonated with your, you know, small town Timmins experience. You could imagine a Nina looking through her coat rack or clothing rack.
Honestly, I think their characters could resonate with anybody on earth. I mean, I think that they're really archetypal type characters that have specific eccentric behavior that right. we all recognize in ourselves and in other people. Frankly, I'm always surprised the kids in the hall aren't 10 times bigger than they are, because to me, those characters always can make a connection with an audience member.
I know so many of Scott's friends, seriously.
That makes a lot of sense. But then, so you had said you immediately kind of felt like you needed to be involved, and you started off sort of more on the writing side of the show in the first season or so, and then the show is, you know, it's picked up, it's on CBC, it's on HBO, and then suddenly in the middle of season two, you're on screen in a towel getting as part of a sweepstakes contest. So how did that come up?
Well, Hans, you just raced through about four important years.
we do have we're going to do some time jumps, but no, please elaborate by all means.
So 85, 86, 87, they did Rivoli shows. I went to every single one. Obviously, I was more than a fan. I was also a friend of the troupe. I was getting to know them. We all always partied together, house parties, going out drinking, going to other shows. So you literally spend seven nights of the week with these people. You get to know them very well. And like I said, I was becoming a huge fan. And then all of a sudden there was this break where Bruce and Mark got hired to write on Saturday Night Live, which was like giant news in the comedy community in Toronto. Dave went to Vancouver to make a movie, and Scott and Kevin joined a Second City touring company. So all of them fractured, but kept busy and then came together again a year later. And that's when I think things really started to heat up, and I started to videotape shows. I was much more involved, always backstage, in doing various things. They finally gave me a job on the TV show, I think just as a favor, just to keep me around, basically. Oh, we like him. Give him something to do. And they made me their assistant, and I was the world's worst assistant. McCullough always talks about how that time I said, you got a phone message, and I handed him a piece of paper, and there were only six numbers written down. So he couldn't make the call. And that first year on the show, like I said, I was mostly the assistant who couldn't do anything properly. But I had started writing with Scott. Obviously, Scott and I had worked together literally from that first time he fell out of the tree. So working together was something we just did, regardless of what our roles were at any specific project. And the other four became aware of it, that I had worked on Buddy Cole pieces and other stuff. And they offered me a writing job. And who's going to say no?
So, you know, you had been working with Scott in film school and elsewhere. And we saw a number of your film footage as part of the Mouth Congress documentary. And it got us wondering whether there's all those little interstitial bits between some of the sketches of just kind of interesting found video footage and things like that. It felt like it matched your style quite a bit. Was any of that found footage from your work with Scott previously, or did you have any involvement in that?
We did shoot that stuff, and it had to be created for the TV show. So we actually, the production got some Super 8 cameras and a ton of black and white Super 8 footage. And we spent a whole day shooting and then used that as the interstitials. The aesthetic came from, I think, Scott's suggestion. when they were working on the pilot, and Robert Boyd was looking for something for interstitials, and Scott said Super 8, even though, I mean, we rarely used Super 8 back in the old days, but he knew what it was, and it turned out to be a great idea. And it, because it's so visually different, remember, this was 1989 that they're making the pilot, 88 89. The idea of mixing visual formats at the time was kind of radical. It was like, yeah, Super 8 looks so different from the high key video that we're shooting the show on, this sort of thing. So it made perfect aesthetic sense, you know?
Now you are on the show, and we get a season in, and suddenly Paul Bellini, the legend, is now showing up on screen. So how did that all come about?
Okay, so they hired three writers, me and Norm Hiscock, who was in a troupe with Mark and Bruce out west, and Brian Hart, who was a stand-up that Bruce knew really well. So we have three writers on the show, finally. And they made a rule that the writers couldn't be in any of the sketches. They didn't just stay writing, right? And we were all fine with it. And then, of course, the first meeting was audience outreach. How do we gauge a true hardcore fan base? Like, there's one thing to look at the ratings and another to understand hardcore fan base. One of the producers said, if we do a direct response contest, one where the viewer has to send in a piece of mail, that usually gives you like a 3% sample that you could build on. That's 3% of the audience is hardcore enough to do that. So we had to come up with an idea. Okay, a Kids in the Hall contest, have lunch with the kids in the hall. Nobody wanted to do that. Somebody said a new car, and Bruce said, no, how about just some old shitbox from a scrapyard? But then the idea of having to transport it was so expensive. They said, no, look, we can't spend that much money. We need a prize. We need to send them a prize that is unique and interesting. And Mark stood up and said, I think we should send them Bellini wearing a towel.
Oh, Mark, interesting. Okay.
And it was such a bizarre, well, a few days before, I was telling Mark about a visit I made to a gay bathhouse.
Sure.
And he said, what do you do there? He's all ears, right? Mark, very interested. Tell me all about it. I said, well, you put all your clothes in a locker, and then you have your key on a little wristband, and you put a towel around your waist, and you walk around looking at the other guys and poking your head in rooms and stuff like that. And Mark thought this was the funniest thing he'd ever heard. Not the idea of doing it, but the idea of me doing it.
Right.
Oh, Mark, you dick.
So he said that I would be a great prize. Bellini in a towel would be a great prize. Everybody laughed, yeah, except me. I thought I was mortified. I said, my God, are they suggesting I have to take my shirt off on television? And this was, to me, horrible because I had this chubby body. I thought, I can't do that to people. I don't want to expose myself. But I was talked into it. And literally 3 hours later, I'm standing in a park getting my picture taken by Norm Hiscock.
Amazing.
for the whole thing. And I realized at the time, you know, you make a deal with the devil, right? And it's I knew that it would make me not so much famous, but renowned, visual commodity on the show. Mm. And I also broke that stupid rule of writers not appearing on the show. Right. And that was my real joy. I thought, yeah, there's with the rules. It's important to break rules. And, you know, we can tell you the rest of it was the fans loved it. The director loved it because it was like one or two takes.
Right.
No makeup. The makeup department. Yes. Because they said, if we do the face, we have to do the whole body. And everybody said, oh, no, just leave it the way it is. The costume is literally something you spend $3 on.
Yes.
So for them, this was the most cost-effective bit of comedy and a very expensive sketch comedy show. So they loved it. The audience loved it immediately. I had a fan club show up at the taping after the first broadcast.
Amazing.
There was only four of them, but they were adorable.
That's amazing. Level
four. Yeah, the Bellini fan club. So, you know, it worked, and it worked well enough to keep bringing it back.
I mean, I wanted to ask too, you said that the original idea was to gauge how many hardcore fans of the show there were. Was it successful engagement? How many hardcore fans were there?
I couldn't give you a number, Trevor, but the producers were happy because it gave them an indication of what to expect for future renewals. And it just allows them to sort of understand the budget. You know, we'd already done one season. It was fairly successful, but the first season and the second season are visually very different.
Yeah.
In the second season, we brought in other directors. We lost Robert Boyd. We brought in other directors. We were in a different studio. We had a much bigger hair and makeup department. Like, everything got more professional in the second season. This was an important chance for them to figure out hardcore. I mean, you know, we had no trouble selling tickets, quite honestly. The show was always a hit, at least locally. But I don't know. I don't know those numbers.
So when those live bits were being filmed in those, were they still at the Rivoli for those, or did they have a separate stage studio for the live sketches that were filmed? I guess that must have been more of a TV studio.
We inherited an old CBC studio not far from where I live, actually. It's now a condominium. They tore it down and put up a condo. And it was where a CBC show called Tommy Hunter, the Tommy Hunter show, was from, which was this country and Western dude. And he was on Friday nights at 9 for about 30 years.
Okay.
And he was shot. They shoot his show at the studio. And he was going out of production. And so they said, well, you guys can have the Tommy Hunter studio. And we loved it because it was street level.
Right.
And our director, John Blanchard, could just walk outside for his cigarette breaks. Whereas had we been in the broadcast center, he would have had to go down an elevator and out the front and smoke in front of the building. So we were there the entire 5 years we were in production.
Okay. And then, we now know how the man in the towel comes out, and then in many ways, but then we wanted to let you know, I don't know if you're aware, but we actually interviewed the American contest winner, back in our second season of the show, Rebecca Klatka. Yeah.
Rebecca and Ramona, yeah, yes. The R girls, yes. Rebecca Klatka, yeah.
So we interviewed her, and she told us all about your raucous disco night at Casey and the Sunshine Band down in Miami.
Yeah, one of the top 10 evenings of my entire life.
Oh my God.
I have to thank them. You know, I'm a huge disco fan, and when I discovered Casey and the Sunshine Band, I bought all the albums in 1 week, and they blew me away. And I would listen to them on headphones, go, how do they do this? When I went to St. Petersburg to shoot the segment, I remember Rebecca and Ramona said, what are you doing tonight? I said, oh, just going back to the hotel. They said, we want to take you to see Casey and the Sunshine Band in Tampa. They play in this club in Tampa. And my heart stopped. I said, are you kidding? Like, it's just,
amazing.
And we drove there, and they drove like maniacs. I was terrified. We get to the club. It's virtually empty.
Oh.
There is the entire 11-piece band on stage, all the original members. Richard Finch was still alive at the time. Mm-hmm. And they did all the hits. And I remember I cried pretty much nonstop through the entire thing. And I was so close. I could reach out and almost touch Casey. It was the best night of my life.
Huh.
And I have to thank them. That was they did me a solid.
Rebecca talked about it glowingly as well. But I didn't realize that Casey and the Sunshine Band was so in particular important to you. So just perfect kismet.
Well,
I'll tell you, worked out that way. Yeah.
When you watch a band like that play, you understand the dynamics of rock and roll. For me, it was valuable because I'm trying to figure out how to make Mouth Congress a thing, and watching how the horn section and how the percussion section worked with the basic guitar drums bass combination, like, just watching them was a revelation. The fact that I'm hearing songs that I love done live and done perfectly was even better, and I'm seeing them perform it. Yeah, it was the best. It was the best thing ever.
Wow, that's very cool. And then now we haven't been able to track down any online vestige of the Canadian winner of that contest, unfortunately. So we haven't been able to do our internet sleuthing to track them down and interview them. But how was that in contrast to the American winner?
Well, he was He was about 14, a real cute little 14-year-old. He brought his friends with him, and we met at the airport. And it was fine, you know, we did all the same gags and stuff. And then we posed with a Mountie on the tarmac. That was exciting.
Right, right.
Amazing.
It certainly wasn't as memorable as Rebecca and Ramona. That was crazy. Then 2 years later, we did the Find Bellini contest, which was me coming out of the condom box. And that's where Norm got down all the good gags of like me on the plane and waiting for my luggage. And then I unzip it and it's the entire suitcase of towels. That, Yes, that was the first one. The second one was the Find Bellini. Mm-hmm. And that was the 11-year-old kid. And the guy from the States was this red-haired guy named, what was his name? Aaron, I think. And we went to Cincinnati and we had to, I took off my shirt at the airport and security swooped in and they were going to arrest me for public nudity. And the producers are going, no, it's a TV segment. Like, this is all pre-permits. We just did things. And they made us rent an entire ballroom to shoot that thing with the fish on the platter and everything.
A ballroom for that. Wow.
We had to rent a ballroom.
Wow.
I wasn't allowed to take my shirt off in the general area of the airport.
Oh, wow. My God. Yeah. I love that.
So now they want everyone to take everything down to just a towel to get through the airport. So, yeah.
Exactly.
You had mentioned that after that first airing, you already had your four members of the Paul Bellini fan club showing up. That turned into its own little cult following and apparently also resulted in a 1993 music festival. What can you tell us about the Bellini Fan Club Music Festival?
The music festival was the four of us.
I love it. Yes.
Four of them and me. It was not very well attended. These four people, it was three girls and a guy, they were so cute. And I made friends with all of them. I went to the wedding of one of them.
Oh, wow.
And I kept up with them for years and years, especially Danielle, the main girl. I haven't heard from anyone in about 20 years, though. Mm. But they were great. They would come to all the tapings with banners that said, like, we love Bellini and stuff. They published a newspaper called the Bellini Bellow. They did about four editions of the Bellini Bellow.
Amazing.
They did a tape of songs about me. They just took popular songs and rewrote them so that my name was in everything. We did that music festival. We did a big day in the park once. We had a Bellini picnic.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, they'd invite a few of their other friends, but it was hardly what you would call like Woodstock. It wasn't a groundswell of people or anything.
There's still time.
Yeah, yeah. There's, you know, one you mentioned it earlier when you were talking about the first appearance of the Paul Bellini in the towel and how you were sort of mortified at the idea of it. But what's funny for us is that, you know, you always seemed very calm and confident and comfortable when in those bits. And I think in general, having looked at the Mouth Congress video as well, we get the impression that you feel relatively comfortable letting the joke be about you with the character of Paul Bellini. So how much do you think that character reflects you in real life and your actual personality?
See, I left out a key part when Mark said Bellini in a towel and everybody laughed and I was immediately mortified. But 1 second later, I said, if I do this, I can cancel out all of the shame and embarrassment that I have felt up till this point in my life. And I was, you know, almost 30 at the time. And I thought, if I do this, I can get over that horrible fear I have of taking off my shirt in public, of showing my body. I'm just going to do it on TV. I'm going to do it big, 100%. And that's it. It's out there. And so that was a really psychotic break for me in a way, because there was no turning back. Right after I did that, I thought, now I can't stop doing it. And in a way, it does open the door. You know, the whole calm presence of the towel guy is quite simply because they didn't want to give me lines because then they'd have to pay me more. But also they were worried I'm not a performer. And if they gave me lines that they would come out sounding clunky and fake and it would take forever to shoot. So they decided instantly, make it a silent character. Let him just say things with his eyes, which I'm really good at, right? Because I have a silent comedian face. And that worked very well until the very last episode when I was given one line of dialogue, which is a kind of a Garbo speaks.
And they spent the whole budget.
Yeah, that's right. I finally got the big check.
For a show with a bit called Screw You Taxpayers, that's awfully stingy of them, yeah.
I know. And the whole thing of me standing like this is literally to secure the towel because I'm just terrified it'll fall off. I'll be standing there in my little underwears. So the whole pose, everything, and not moving too much is because I didn't really want to jiggle. I mean, there's a real reason for everything I did, but the overall effect was this calmness.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's so fun. I think of you on the escalator, just like perfectly motionless.
You know, they don't make fun of you per se, too. Like Mark refers to you as an interesting physical specimen.
Yes, yes. Because I think everyone, even at the time, is very conscious. You don't want this to be a fat joke. You don't want it to be, look at the fat guy. Mm-hmm. But the character is me, and I was fat and still am. And that couldn't be why you're laughing at this person. You're laughing at him because you're thinking, what is he thinking? What is going on behind those scary eyes that is, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I think that whole idea of me being like a silent comedian is really, really key to that character.
So we wanted to get a little bit more of the substantive stuff about writing and Kids in the Hall. And so let's start with a little kind of more of an emotional question to start. You told us that you had saw all of their shows when they were starting getting in their inception at the Rivoli. So what was it like seeing, like for you to see the transfer from this kind of more grassroots, you know, live show to having a TV show?
To be honest, the first thing I thought was that the TV show kind of diminished their impact. That they were so good on stage and so funny that by producing the sketches, by building the characters and the creating sets and everything, by bringing in that live audience, that all of these things actually were half as good as they were live. And you know, it doesn't sound very fair, but those live shows were really good. I mean, you have no idea. The first time I saw Citizen Kane, I laughed so hard. I thought I almost threw up. It was so funny. And then, you know, now I'm a big fan of the live sketch and I watch it all the time and it is really great. It's probably my favorite sketch of all time. But it doesn't even compare to what they did live. Those live shows were so hot. You have no idea.
Is it just something about the energy? Like they work with the crowd more? Or is it just like you have to be
They are one with the crowd. They are really good at bringing that audience right in, embracing the audience and making sure the audience is actually part of the process. So, and the Rivoli is not a big club. It maybe seats maybe 100, 120 people. But you can imagine that everybody in there was part of that show. And, you know, when Kevin would break the fourth wall, like a lot of times, you know, if Kevin didn't like how a scene was going, he'd just go, and he'd drop dead. He'd literally just fall to the ground and lie there. And you can't imagine how funny that was because I'd never seen anybody do anything like that. It was just great.
What does it mean for you? Like, do you feel like you have a particular take on the aesthetic of it? Or like, did it have a certain meaning for you as it came out?
You know, Lorne Michaels was always adamant about producing the show in Canada, in Toronto. He realized, because he's a genius, that when you keep the boys down on the farm, they're going to do hard work. And they're not going to let crazy stuff go to their heads. There would be no distractions. No one, there would be no media. There would be no fans. There literally are none in Toronto, trust me. And it allowed us to make the show in a very pure way, without any kind of adulterating factors. So that was a really brilliant move to keep us here and keep it pure. And also, you know, the amount of work we did in 5.5 years is 100 episodes of over 700 sketches, which is a lot of work. The aesthetic was always, I think, come from them too. You know, the pilot is done in front of this kind of a brick wall, and there's an attempt to do sketches in front of this brick wall as though there was still kind of a stage, on stage type format thing. And that was dispensed with immediately. But there was always that ragtag aesthetic, that it was a coming together, a bag of old sweaters and three hats. And that's all you needed to do this great work. So that was always that, you know, a lot of that comes from McCullough. McCullough is very much anti-Hollywood, anti-glamour and phoniness. And he wanted always to keep it very real. Like he always said, we're like, you know, sitting in the back of a pickup truck driving down a dirt road. Yeah. And that was, I think, the vision, that it was a very Canadian approach to show business, an anti-glamour, so to speak.
Yeah, when I was just even watching it visually, a lot of it feels very DIY and a kind of punk thing that you see more with music. And I think it's tremendously important for that.
Well, also, you know, we came of age in the punk generation. So, I mean, that was very much of that, that just grab an instrument and start playing, even though you don't have any training. That it was exciting to sing, even though you can't really sing. It was always about that do-it-yourself kind of aesthetic, right?
Oh, I think that's one of the reasons it's held up so much. Like, there's nothing like it, you know? You told me that on the first two seasons, you were the world's worst assistant. Was that your main gig, or were you doing other stuff at the time?
Oh, no, that was a full-time job. You got to remember, I because I had videotaped most of the live shows and was present at all the live shows, sometimes I did board op, you know, lights and music and stuff. I'd always do posters and hang posters for the show. I was kind of functioning as an assistant anyway. And like I said, I think they just wanted to keep me around, which is why they gave me a job. But it was obvious that I wasn't built for that, you know?
You're a funny guy. You gotta use your talents.
Literally everybody on the show was funny. I mean, we really had a charmed crew. You know, sometimes they'd be like the old CBC lifers who all of a sudden really got into it and started to do the best work of their careers, because finally, instead of doing this boring country and Western music show, they had to do crazy. They had to build a chicken lady costume and do it in a week. and the challenge was so exciting that it brought out the best in everyone.
Oh, and it's lucky about how well, like, for such a small crew and cast, everyone performs, it seems, just like 100%.
It was a lucky show. I mean, there was nothing like it. We all knew how lucky we were. And we were all paid very well comparatively for a Canadian show anyway. We just had, you know, it was just great.
Was there a particular story about when they asked you to be a writer initially, or is just they were kind of like, Paul, you need to stop poorly taking messages?
No, I heard that they were hiring writers and I asked if I could be one. And I think it was like a sympathy job. I think that they were thinking is, oh, yeah, let's hire him so he can write with Scott, so Scott will make us crazy all the time. And it kind of worked out that way. So,
and you tended to sort of pair off for that?
You know, when you're on the show, you work with everybody as much as you can. The whole thing is about chemistry. So you want to blend in. You want to bring your best for every pitch meeting. Obviously, there were certain teams that were more consistent. Like Kevin always teamed up a lot with Norm Hiscock. Dave liked to work with Kevin a lot. And Scott and I worked together because we were the gay ones, you know.
Yeah. But it also seems like you're a bit of a grounding force for Scott, too, to some extent.
Somebody has to be. You just want to contribute as much as possible all the time.
Absolutely. Would you talk to me a little bit about what the vibe in the writing room was like? Like, did you guys have a particular process?
It was generally horrible. you know, Bruce said, this is not 9 to 5. Come in when you want and write what you want. Mm. That was his thing. And he often did that. He would come in sometimes with 6 or 7 written sketches that he had dictated to an assistant and were all typed up and ready to go. And Scott and I tended to show up late in the afternoon, watch TV, eat dinner, smoke joints, and then work on a sketch for 3 or 4 hours. And then on the way home, hit a bar. Mm-hmm. So that was our schedule. It was different for everybody. And then we'd have these read-throughs, which would be these massive packages, sometimes 30 or 40 sketches. And we'd read them. The cast would read them. And then we'd have these giant arguments and screaming sessions over what worked and what didn't. And it was sometimes really, really edgy. Like, it would get to, I wouldn't say furniture being thrown, but I do remember one time Scott kicking in a filing cabinet over something. So it was very rambunctious. And then after a few days, we'd come together again with rewrites and choose what was going into production. Actually, the kids never chose. The producers would choose, which was a good idea because, first of all, that's their job.
Yeah.
And secondly, they're a little less partial or a little more partial. So it was easier than, you know, the main thing too is if your writing doesn't get accepted, at least you got some good parts to look forward to.
You were saying that you were kind of paired off with Scott for most of your writing. Do you have a particular sketch that you were particularly proud of having written?
The favorite ones that I did with him, with Thompson, I love Girls of Summer, the Buddy Cole coaching lesbian softball team.
The Sappho Sluggers. I love that.
Sappho Sluggers. I also remember the one where Danny Husk finds out, he goes to work one day, finds out he's been kidnapped and has to pay ransom money. So I was happy with those because they were both my ideas. I didn't write them, but they were ideas that I had. I loved Spy Models, which was Francesca Fiori, this massive, it took 3 days to shoot. It was such a massive undertaking. Oh, Mark's head in the toilet with the plunger. It's fantastic.
Yes.
My most favorite is the one from fourth year. I think it's Needed Elsewhere. It's the gay couple inviting the straight couple over for dinner. And one of the Scott's character is constantly running upstairs to do cocaine in the bathroom.
Oh, yes. Right.
And Mark's character doesn't have a single line of dialogue in the entire thing. He just shrugs and shows his teeth. That was one of my favorites. So it's those are the ones that stand out for me. I mean, there was lots of others, obviously, but those are the four that I just love.
That one's really strong. The you know, it's funny that you characterize it as like, oh, I was paired off because we were the gay ones, but you wrote the Danny Husk, a lot of the Danny Husk characters, which are like such a prototypical, like, dudesly dude, you know?
Well, we know guys like that.
Yeah.
You know? So it wasn't hard to create for that character. It was a lot of fun. I mean, the other one we did with Danny Husk was the one where his porno past is revealed. And he actually shot this sleazy little Super 8 movie where he's in a hotel room with a woman. That was a fun one we did too.
You were writing with Scott. Did you see behind any of the veil for how the other kids wrote, or like were you privy to that at all? Was Bruce just very secretive?
Well, it was always fun to write with Kevin. Okay. Kevin's very self-deprecating. And
our Kevin, really?
Oh, he's very funny. He's great. We did a thing called Big in France that was quite fun. Mr. Foley, of course, I just adore his huge talent. I never really wrote with Dave. I wrote in a room with Dave, but I never wrote just a piece with him. Mm-hmm. Bruce always took care of me.
Yeah.
Bruce is like my daddy, and he was always super helpful. I remember when we did the Tammy sketches, how much fun we had. Mark was always the interesting one because Mark had this whole process and it was built around wasting time. So he'd say, come over and we'll write. And you'd go over and spend the whole day flipping through magazines or doing laundry.
Mm-hmm.
You do everything but right.
Yeah.
And then in the last hour, I'd say, Mark, I got to go. It's like 7:30 p.m. And he'd go, oh, let's just work on this sketch. And, you know, we'd spend like 20 minutes on it. And that was it.
Yeah.
And then he'd go, come back tomorrow. And so to write with Mark, you know, you'd have to block off a week, basically, to do a sketch. But Mark is, you know, he's really such an incredible performer,
mm-hmm.
that for him, it takes a long time to seize on what he really wants to do in the sketch and then kind of build everything around that. The one we worked on was the waiters with the decorating the plates,
the dipping areas,
the dipping areas.
Yeah.
That was the one that he and I worked on. And then everyone contributed. You know, the thing is, I might've written the first draft with him, but then everybody else comes together during rehearsal, creates their own characters, builds lines. It was always a super collaborative process. It was rarely, was there something, maybe even a monologue maybe is the only thing that might require a lot less input.
Yeah, they almost dunk on Mark a little bit like that in the new season, where they're all coming together to break down the sketch. Like, and Mark's going to do a needlessly complicated character, I guess. And he like turns from the back wall and gets into it.
Well, they were always really good at making fun of themselves, because I think they understand their chemistry and their own personalities and their public personas. And because they're not really pretentious guys. Right. Or they're really good at kind of creating that, mocking themselves.
Well, speaking of chemistry, would you talk to me a little bit about your relationship with Scott while you were writing, but you were friends before? Like, did it evolve over the five seasons that you're working on the original show? Did it change as you started to write together?
It's interesting, you know, because we started Mouth Congress in 1984, like a few months before he joined Kids in the Hall. Mouth Congress was always very equal. In fact, I'm much more of the driving force behind the band. Whereas in Kids in the Hall, it's reversed. He's the boss. He's the actor and the guy who's doing the character. And I'm the guy who's helping him figure out what to do. So getting used to that different chemistry for every different project took a long time, took about, you know, 10 or 15 years to sort out. And, you know, we've always had a kind of sometimes we're very contentious and we'll have a fight and not speak to each other for a year, that sort of thing. Although since the cancer, that hasn't happened. The cancer back in, 2009? So since then, we've gotten along really great. And the fact that we were able to always keep all these things going well into our 60s, I think really says our level of devotion to our own projects and our own material. The thing is that we're very different people and we have very different processes. So for me, it's about learning how to control his wild ideas. And for him, it's about shaking me out of my comfort zone. We always have to find the middle ground in order for something to work, whatever it is, a monologue, a song, some kind of bigger project, a stage thing. It has to be, we have to find that middle ground to make it work.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the reasons that some of those sketches are so strong, because you have that kind of Lennon-McCartney tempering element.
Right? Yeah, but I don't think I would have been very good as a performer. I think the thing, and even when we do Mouth Congress shows, he does tend to walk all over me on stage because I don't have what he has. I don't have that ability to seduce an audience. I don't have that strength. I don't have the vocal power. I don't have the daring. And so I kind of stand there like just like a houseplant and let him take over. You just can't even compete. And that allows him to sort of integrate me into his vision, usually by building a joke around me.
And like we'd said earlier, it seems like, you know, on the show, the joke is not necessarily at you, but it's very self-deprecating in that way. And we noticed when we were watching the Mouth Congress documentary.
You know, comedy is about losers. So you, in order to be funny, you have to tap into that loser part of yourself and you have to be willing to show it. Because that's what is common for people. That's what they see when they see comedy is, oh, that's happened to me. You know, that identification with misfortune is really what comedy is all about. So for me, it's about, oh, look at me. Don't you feel sad for me? You know, this kind of thing. Yeah. This kind of thing. And that, I think that's funny. I think that's what makes it funny.
Is that just a little bit more of the like patter that you get into with Scott? Because he really dunks on you in the show when you didn't
know. Oh, his creative notes are brutal to watch.
Harsh, let's say. Yes, harsh.
Well, you know, I think you're talking about us doing the gerbil song.
Yes, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, that song, we just finished recording it. We recorded 16 new songs. And Gerbil was one of them. And I have to say, it astonishes me. It's so good. I mean, our band is so hot, and I give a great vocal performance. But at first, when he handed me some of those lyrics, I thought, fuck, I can't say this. This is like unbelievable. And it's not that it was shocking. It's just that there would be so many words that I'm trying to think, how do I sing that phrase? Mm. There's too many syllables. So a lot of it is just trying to make it work, right?
Mm-hmm.
But for him, and this is why I think the Kids in the Hall were great, is that all five of them are the same. They never settled for a first thought, best thought type thing. They love to rewrite. Mm-hmm. If you come up with an idea, somebody else adds to the idea. But it has to be refined. It can't just be a pile of dumb ideas. It has to actually... So they did more rewriting than any other comedian I've ever seen, right? And then they'd go through a rehearsal process with the director that was extensive. Then they would shoot, and they would shoot variations. Then they would go in the editing room and work on the edit. And at every process, that sketch was becoming sharper, clearer, and stronger, and funnier. So nothing was, you know, people go, oh, I bet you guys improvised a lot. No, hardly ever.
Yeah.
None of that was improv. It was all, you know, planned and directed and performed.
Well, speaking of collaborators and writing, do you feel like the energy or the output of the show changed when they brought you on as a writer, like when they included more staff like that?
It got a lot better.
Agreed.
Well, I tell you, like I said, the second season, it was a huge step up. And a lot of it was just simply making it look better. You know, HBO saying, we like this show, but it has to have a little bit more gloss. So, and also at a certain point, you bring in even more writers because you realize this thing is exhausting me. We have to write so much stuff for this show to work that it's an endless drain on your brain. It's like you really do need the help of other creative people. So if everyone around you can contribute, and sometimes even a crew guy would come up with a hilarious joke and it would be thrown in, although I can't think of any examples, but I definitely remember that atmosphere was everybody felt like they were part of that show. You know, the Amazon thing was interesting because there was no audience. Right. We shot it during quarantine. So everything was like, I remember when I was on set being sequestered in a trailer and then masked everywhere, except when you're actually on camera or getting makeup. And there was no camaraderie. I never knew anyone's name. There was no joking around. There was none of that. Feel free to contribute. And you're all part of a process thing. Because you couldn't, you were masked and sequestered the entire time. So it was definitely a different kind of show.
This is kind of a stupid question, but we noticed that as the seasons go on, they start including other actors, specifically women later on. Was there a particular reason for this, or is it just sort of like they were just getting tired of playing so many characters?
A lot of those women were friends of ours, and you know, you just want to give them parts because you like them. You know, they're good at something, and like Darlene Treen or Diane Flax or who else was on the show? I can't remember. But I mean, you just want them to be on it. That's all. Now, the part of Laura did call for a nice looking young girl, right? You couldn't have put Kevin in makeup and have, you know, because all right away, you've got the stretch with Bruce playing a much younger character. So he had to find a girl that we understand when we see her face, she's the young girlfriend, right? Right?
Well, perfect. You know, I think that's about it for me for behind the scenes. I'm going to pass it over to Kalina, the actual journalist here.
Well, mine will hopefully be a bit rapid fire. We're kind of going to do sort of standouts and highlights, which I know you kind of touched on a little bit already. But I mean, you know, we talk about sort of these boundary pushing elements of the show often intersecting with the queer content. What were some of the most memorable queer sketches for you?
Well, I cannot underestimate the impact of Buddy Cole, which, you know, was something that Thompson and I were at a house party and we met this wild queen from Quebec. He was very attractive, but really insulting. Just a horrible guy. And left an incredible impression. And I believe Scott went on a date with him and told me of the line. He said, Carol said, I may have been born yesterday, but I still went shopping. And I remember I wrote it down in my cigarette pack because I thought it was so good. And then a few weeks later, we were improvising with the camera. And I reminded him of that line. And that kind of became the whole basis for the improv that where Buddy emerged from. Buddy, we knew immediately, was important because we needed a gay character, I think. The two of us needed a gay character as a voice. He was always effeminate, but he was much more soft-spoken. And then I think when Scott finally put him on stage, he realized he had to project, and Buddy became more alpha. Buddy always was sexual. He was not a shrinking violet or like, ooh, I can't do it. He was a very sexual person, like Thompson. So all these elements started to emerge. And the fact that he was successful at the Rivoli shows really helped because those monologues were always big laugh getters. And I think that's basically how Scott learned to write, was by doing the Buddy monologues. So that was super important. Then later on the television show, you know, other things come into play. We wanted to create other queer characters or gay characters, right? The Steps guys, another one of Scott's best ideas. This was a real coffee shop in Toronto, and all the gay guys would sit on the steps and evaluate whoever was walking by. It was hilarious. Yeah. And he said, we should do a scene. He goes, you know, three friends. And we decided they should be really three very different types of gay archetypes because our group was all very diverse, right? So those ideas, I think, were really important to us and to the show. The other ones, I think they really were very forward-thinking people in understanding that, you know, because there wasn't a lot of gay content on TV at the time, like I would say almost none. So it made the show stand out. It made it seem hip and edgy in a way that other TV shows and other comedy shows were not. So it was important to everybody that this stuff be in the show. But really important to me and Scott, obviously. Yeah.
Did you ever get any pushback from producers or anyone else sort of at higher level about sort of that queer content?
Never.
Really?
Although I do remember... we wrote a Buddy monologue where, and it's a joke he still tells on stage, about how he was, first time he had sex was, he was 9 years
old, right.
14.
Yeah.
I can't remember. And, the other guys were horrified and said, you can't say that on television. And I don't know, was it in the monologue? I can't even remember. That was the Paris monologue.
It was.
Listen,
exactly.
The character is all about exaggeration and hyperbole. But that was the only time I think that the other guys were actually horrified by something. Generally, they let us get away with whatever we wanted.
And to go back to Steps for a second, did you feel like you fell into or reflected any of those archetypes that you guys were putting on screen?
Well, they were based on three of our closest friends.
Right. So,
and it's great because when you base a character on one of your closest friends, they either pretend they don't get it or they really don't get it.
Did Butch not get it?
Butch was never quite flattered by it necessarily.
The mesh shorts with the cowboy boots. Oh my God.
I would have thought that Kevin's intellectual character would have been the one most offended, perhaps. But
did all of the troop members start creating or contributing to that queer content, or did that usually fall just to you and Scott?
None of them were against it, obviously. They were like, they all play gay, let's be honest. Kevin's really good at it. Mark's good at it. They all did. Every one of them played gay. And I think they just considered it other character work, much like doing female characters. It was, you know, when you're a sketch comedian, you are devoted to the creation of characters, because that character gives you a point of view with which to express a certain type of humor. So sketch comedians love creating characters. And the Kids in the Hall never had boundaries on the type of characters they created.
And even in the writing, I mean, were they starting to maybe suggest any, would Scott even allow, say, lines for Buddy's monologues? Or did they start kind of feeling comfortable saying, hey, you know, what about, you know, putting this into the step sketch, stuff like that?
Well, nobody touched the Buddy monologues, quite honestly, because you couldn't. I mean, they had to come from him, obviously. No, you know what? Sometimes we want to correct them. But, yeah. Well, it's not really like that, Dave. You know, days do this, actually. You know, there'd be that. But that to me is just part of getting it right.
Right.
And if you're going to do a character, you want it to be as right as possible, because that's where the true comedy lays, not in the exaggeration, but in the accuracy. And I think people always miss that. Young comedians always miss that point. And they tend to go for exaggerating stereotypes rather than looking at interesting eccentricities of a character.
You've touched on a couple of standout sketches so far, but we really want to get your top three.
Well, I think I've already said that Citizen Kane is probably my most favorite sketch of all time. The other one I love is Scott and Dave did this thing called Lady is a Tramp.
Yes.
Yeah, Dave plays a kind of a Ronald Coleman, if a kind of very cultured British gentleman. And Scott's this kind of like 1970s hooker stereotype right out of Taxi Driver. And they meet on a bridge. And he falls in love with her and proposes marriage and marries her. And she never stops being a hooker. And at the end, she presents him with a like $10 billion hooker bill or something. And they even have grandchildren at this point. That I think is just, I teach courses in sketch and I always drag that one out because I think it is close to absolutely perfect. You know, God, just the hundreds. I'm having trouble remembering them.
It's so hard. I mean, we even struggle when we do in single episode to kind of agree and parse them out. So I totally get it.
What's your favorite, Kalina?
Oh my God.
Kalina, you know what it is. You know what it is. It's Chad's 13th birthday. You yell about that almost every time.
It absolutely is. $10. It absolutely is.
The one where Bruce brings his kid to the Rock and gets pathetically drunk in front of him for his 13th birthday.
They built that Rock.
Oh, wow.
No, it was a big CBC prop. They found the location. They needed the Rock, right? I love Daddy Drank, which is, I think, very similar. The one where he's wearing tap shoes and he comes into the son's room to strangle him. I mean, you know, it's unbelievable. Such good stuff. On the new show, Baby Drop made me laugh so hard. Oh, my God. When the ashtray's on the belly and... Oh, it just...
I love the part where he's like, I've got a 50% drop. You find another doctor that's dropping babies less often than me.
The physical comedy of him just juggling the greasy baby is like perfect. Yeah,
Mr. Foley, what can I say?
He's, yes.
So good.
There must have been some real shit takes, though. And, you know, we always do sort of our tops and bottoms as appropriate. What were some of the worst sketches, in your opinion, that shouldn't have gone to air?
I remember... Scott Kevin did this thing called the editors.
Cut it!
And as the two, and I remember thinking, this is so bad. I hated it. Just one of those things you just, oh my God.
I mean, was there anything also that was cut that should have stayed and aired, in your opinion?
We did one Buddy Cole piece that I loved and it never made it to air. It was called Buddy and Bob's. And it's about how Buddy has three straight friends and they're all named Bob. And every Tuesday night they come over and they play ping pong and get drunk together. And we did it all with slides. And quite honestly, it was so perfect and it never made it to air. A great tragedy. I just love that piece. Other The other piece that I always kind of regretted, Pizza Pizza, which was the one where Bruce is kind of this trashy guy and he's got Kevin's the pregnant girlfriend. Huh. And they go into the pizza parlor and Mark is the kind of British twit serving pizza slices. And it's all of this confrontation. And that was shot three separate times.
Wow.
And when they used to do it live, it was just an onslaught of swearing. It was just, it was at the Rivoli, it was just crazy. It was the funniest sketch. Kevin used to kill me in that. So everybody was brilliant. And then they shot it and it didn't work. Then they rewrote it and shot it and it didn't work. And then they rewrote it again and shot it. And it still didn't really work, but I think that one was on TV, right?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Well, you would have heard it 1,000 times if you'd seen it at the Rivoli. And it was one of the best examples of escalation. I mean, it just, he comes in and it's do you work here? Do you sell slices? And it just, from there, it gets uglier and uglier. And that was one of the all-time great pieces. I remember I laughed so hard. And yet it never worked on television.
I think we really have loved hearing about sort of where a lot of these characters have been plucked from in your guys' real life.
Well, that's where they come from, real life. The crushing your head. He was, I think, Mark's landlord.
Oh. Oh, Jesus.
Oh no, pardon me. No. I'm confusing
eyebrows. Yeah.
There was the racist cab driver too.
Amazing.
That's kind of
That was the landlord. Neuville Tizek.
Oh, amazing.
Neuville Tizek was just him and Kevin at a coffee shop going like this to people.
Well, no, thank you so much. That's all for my segment, but I'll hand over to Trevor now.
So I think for our segment, we'd like to dive into some of your career outside of Kids in the Hall, too. We all have access to your IMDb, but maybe just like to start us off, would you like to just sort of run us through what you consider some of your like highlights and lowlights of your career outside of Kids in the Hall?
Nothing really topped it, unfortunately. Like, I mean, I was lucky that I got hired on This Hour's 22 Minutes when it was starting. And it was such an excellent show. And I was there in the first 6 years, which were the Rick Mercer years. And we had Mary Walsh and Kathy Jones and Greg Toomey. And
you won a writing award for that too, didn't you?
Several, actually. I won all the awards I have are for 22 Minutes. None of them were for Kids in the Hall. And 22 Minutes taught me a totally different style of comedy because it was satire. It was news-based, and it wasn't so much character-oriented, although Mary and Kathy were character comedians. They were geniuses. Kathy's one of the best, right? So it was a different type of show and a different living experience. I had to move to Halifax for the entire time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I did like doing that show. I'm very fond of those years. Then, you know, I did a bunch of like crap cartoons and cooking shows, award shows, just gross stuff that I would never even watch. And at a certain point, you think, oh, my God, is this my career? I started on top and I'm sliding down the hill.
And now you're here with us.
But I'll tell you, I was always lucky. The kids in the hall always took care of me. And whenever they were active, they made a place for me in the project that they were doing. I was in Brain Candy. I was in Death Comes to Town. I did a little writing on Death Comes to Town. It was great fun. The new show I was involved in, I've done little tours and live shows with them. In fact, two nights ago, I did a live show with Bruce and Kevin at the Rivoli.
Cool. Oh,
it was so much fun. And when you do that, I remember, oh my God, Kevin's the most fun. I forgot. He's so fun. But yeah, you know, they always make room for me. I'm always part of stuff. And I don't think you get a better little comedy career than that. But the other stuff I do is stuff to keep myself busy. You know, I do love Mouth Congress because it started off as a kind of a basement jam and weird experimentation. It was me with a 4-track recorder and a bunch of different musicians, and Scott and I would do vocals on things. And it was a lot of fun. We were very, you know, nothing mattered because we weren't releasing our music or anything. It was just for us. And then we had an opportunity to put on an album. And then we had an opportunity to record all new stuff. And I like doing songs. Songs are different. They're like sketches in so many ways. They're about the same amount of time and they require as much work, but they're a whole different thing and they're performed a little differently.
I always found it interesting, like, that once we learned about Mouth Congress, Scott didn't do more music on the show. Most of the music is Bruce on the show, too. Was there a reason for that?
Yeah, because Scott has no musicality. He's he's perfect for Mouth Congress because Mouth Congress is a thing that was built around him that he can move around inside of. And he understands it. And it unleashes a certain thing. Scott's got great energy on stage. He's like an Iggy Pop on stage. He's just a wild man, right? But he doesn't really understand song structure or melodies, or he doesn't listen to a lot of other records. You know, Kevin was the music fan. Bruce as well, obviously. The two of them did a lot of the song stuff. But also the Kids in the Hall show didn't really have a place for songs and music. That really wasn't the focus of what we were doing. So Mouth Congress was a totally different thing.
I am interested in hearing more about Mouth Congress though. Was it something that you had ambitions for it to evolve into a larger band, or did you see it more as an artistic creative outlet?
I think it was always a mistake. In that, like, I had a friend from Halifax who we went to university with, and he said he had a band, and I said, I want to start a band, and he laughed and he said, go rent a beatbox and see what you can do. So I did. This was 1984. I got a little Korg beatbox, so boop, 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 boop. And we started with that and then gradually attracted other musicians into the fold and started doing shows, and the shows were goofy with costumes and comedy and shit. And then they became more of a rock and roll thing. And now it's a full band and us, you know, blowing our voices out in front of a full band. It follows that pattern, I guess. But it's all about the song topics. That's what really matters to Scott, for instance, what the song is about. That's why, you know, he wouldn't let me get away with a bland lyric about how great I am. He wanted, if he goes, it should be about your spirit animal, and your spirit animal is a gerbil. And I laughed so hard when he said that. And I think that song is indicative of what Mouth Congress is, basically. Music that goes farther than what other people do.
Well, we watched the Mouth Congress documentary, and we did have some questions because we read Scott saying that it was mostly a more of a mockumentary, and some things were embellished or fabricated to fit an agenda. So which parts are real and which parts are fake?
The only part that's really fake is that whole thing about Red Balloon number 9, the song in the video that's so bad it may have been the cause of AIDS.
Oh, yes. Yes, that's right. Yes.
None of that was true.
But it was a real meltdown before the show?
Oh, none of that was staged. Oh, that we just...
Oh, boy.
You know, the guys shooting it were, like, really close friends of ours, so they never got in the way, and they just shot everything that we did. And, in fact, it was their idea that we do a live reunion show, because they thought, you kind of need a framework for all this archival footage. And that became the basis of the movie, us rehearsing and planning the show and then performing it. But no, it's all real. Like I said, the only really, and the whole Kevin and melancholy, I don't know if Kevin would be that nice an uncle.
Oh, you know, you said you described Scott as being not particularly musical, but the band is actually quite good. And before we started diving into it, you know, we had expected queer punk to be like punk, but when we were watching, comparing them favorably to like the Talking Heads and so forth, they're a tight band. We're interested because Shadowy Men on a Shadowy Planet was so involved in the live tapings and so forth of Kids in the Hall. Did Mouth Congress ever kind of cross-pollinate as well, or was it always like a very separate project?
We opened for them once at the Cameron House. They were, they were so good. I just saw Brian Connolly the other night. It's so nice to see him. There was no real, you know, they were really professional and they had already established themselves in town long before the Kids in the Hall started shooting. In fact, most of their records had been released around the same time that we were just starting the show. And the show was great for them because I'm sure they made a lot of money playing. They were our live house band. They did all the interstitials. You know, it worked out really good for them, and they were perfect for us. They created that sound, right? But you got to remember, in the 80s, everybody did everything. You did comedy, you did rock and roll, you did everything because you could. There was not so much, this place only shows comedians, this place only does rock and roll. Venues didn't care. You got something you want to put on stage so our drunks can watch something? Yeah, sure, go ahead. And it was that do-it-yourself era. Every poster was a Xerox that you would Xerox at work and then just hang them on telephone posts throughout the city. Almost every comedian I know had a rock band and vice versa. It was almost as though the two things were the same side, like both sides of the same coin in a way. So it was not uncommon for people to do both. It's still not really. I mean, you still meet a lot of comedians who have rock bands and stuff.
Do you feel that though there's more of a corporatization or formalization of like amateur entertainment now?
Here's the thing. What are you in it for? Are you in it for likes and follows, or are you in it because you really love doing it and you want to share what you do with the world? And I think back then, we were workaholics. We just would spend all our waking hours doing this stuff. I mean, the reason why the show was good is because that's all we did for those years. I mean, we barely had relationships with other people. We just worked on that show. Now I don't quite get the model. I think it's a little different. A lot of my students, rather than going out on stage and doing shows, will do a YouTube clip. And it might turn out really good. But to me, that's not how you become a good comedian. Even if the results are okay, and some of those clips are really turn out really funny, but that's more to be towards building towards a film career, not towards a stage career. You want to be as good on stage, you have to be on stage.
So you've mentioned you have a career as a teacher too. More of a focus on comedy writing or comedy performing?
Well, I'm lucky. I teach sketch comedy writing at Humber College, which has a dedicated two-year diploma program for comedy. And, you know, they teach everything, stand-up, improv, acting for comedy, and this and blah, physical comedy, all these other things. And I do the sketch program. And I love it. In fact, I learned more about sketch writing in the last 10 years teaching than I did in the first 25 years actually doing it. Because when you're doing it, you don't really analyze what you're doing. You're just trying to figure out stuff that works for the show. But now somebody goes, why is that funny? And I have to explain to them why it's funny, theoretically or mechanically.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's all about how a joke is timed or how it's set up. To me, setup is a crucial thing in comedy writing, that the way to a laugh is to make sure that you pave that road towards the laugh, right? And there's an awareness of comedy that I never had when I was doing it. Now I do, because I have to explain it.
At this point, you have to have students that were born like this side of the 2000s. So are many of them familiar with your work?
Some of them not at all, which is interesting. And I also do Second City classes, and this always happens. I go in and I'll introduce myself. I'll mention Kids in the Hall. There, no light bulbs go on. And then the next week they come in with this look like,
oh,
because they've looked at all the YouTube clips and they realize, wow, oh, this weird guy is famous. Now they really want to be impressed, you know?
So it is actually quite common that they've never heard of you or Kids in the Hall prior to entering classes, though. That's crazy.
Blows my mind.
Despite the Amazon launch, which seemed like a big to-do and a big hoopla and everything, it's funny because I don't know if it really expanded the brand much beyond the hardcore fan base. And the hardcore fan base has kept us going for a long time, 40 years now. And it is hardcore. I mean, the kids can still sell out stadiums and stuff. Well, not stadiums, but decent-sized theaters, right? Good-sized venues. And that's great. the fans are still there. And you know, we did a Mouth Congress show in Philadelphia. Everybody in the audience was about 50 and over. They loved it.
Oh, yeah.
They acted like kids. And that was the most thrilling thing for me was, here's a room full of older people and they're watching us and they're acting like they're 17.
Losing their shit.
So yeah. Beyond teaching, we'd like to hear what you're working on these days. We understand you might be working on a documentary with Bruce, maybe, about Buddy Cole, though.
You know, this is a funny story. So a year ago, I put some clips on YouTube with 3 views. I mean, it's ridiculous, right? No one finds my YouTube clips. And they were all like old Buddy Cole things. And this girl wrote to me and she wrote these long, eloquent emails asking me all these questions. And the only way to answer it, I thought, was, oh, we'll do a Zoom chat. She was really interested in a lot of things. And we did a Zoom chat. And the next thing I know, she said, I want to come and see your band in Toronto. She was in Boston. And I said, okay, next time we do a show, I'll let you know. And she did. She drove up with her whole family and came to the show. And then did it again. And we got to know each other quite well. And then Bruce was doing a show in Boston. And she said, I really want to meet Bruce. I said, well, here's his assistant's email address. Why don't you send her a polite inquiry? And so Bruce met her. And this girl's name is Jessamine Manchester. And he loved Jessamine the way I did. Mm-hmm. And now every time she comes to town, we're giving her projects to do. She's like 20 years old and we're dumping all this stuff on her. And she said, I want to make a little Buddy Cole movie for YouTube, you know, just the origins of Buddy Cole. And Bruce said, no, we're going to make a professional feature length film about Buddy Cole. Yes. And she thought, how we do that? And he goes, well, we're going to do a Kickstarter campaign or one of those GoFundMes. And he goes, you're going to take the money and you're going to shoot a professional movie.
Wow.
And so all of a sudden we got this poor 20-year-old making her film debut. But I think it's really important because, you know, we did Comedy Punks 2 years ago,
right,
which was for Amazon. And it was great. I got to finally, all that footage that I shot over the years, I finally got to put it somewhere. And it was, you know, it was so important to fill in the background. And that's why I shot that stuff back then, in the hopes that somebody would one day make a documentary about us. And they did. And the Mouth Congress thing, same reason. We had all that great archival footage. We just thought this needs to be out there. And now we're doing this with the Buddy Cole character. And Buddy Cole, like I said, a very important character to me. My bread and butter. Have any of you heard the audio version of Buddy Babylon?
No.
I don't know.
We have.
Listen, I think it's maybe the best thing I've ever been associated with. Scott went in and did the whole thing. He recorded the entire audiobook for Audible. And it is the best thing ever. Oh. I mean, I don't know if you've ever read the book. The book is very, obviously, I'm very fond of the book. It's an important thing for me in my career. But the audiobook is even better.
Huh? Well, yeah, let's listen to it.
Putting it on the list.
Putting it
on. Put it on the list. And we want to take all this Buddy Cole stuff. There's so much of it. I mean, he just did a 3-show run in Los Angeles doing Buddy Cole stuff. So the character is still very much alive for us. Very important as a moneymaker and as a calling card. And to me, really important to keep an openly gay male character in comedy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they come and they go because, you know, you had the men on film in Living Color. You had Stuart Smalley on Saturday Night Live. You know, there was always one, but Buddy is the most consistent and long running, I think. And hopefully we keep him going for at least another 20 years.
Obviously on the podcast, we talk about this all the time, how historically significant it is, where there was a queer character on television and the joke wasn't on him.
It wasn't that he was queer. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That wasn't the laugh line. Like, he had laugh lines.
You know, I wish more gay men had figured that out because we got a lot of blowback from the community and I don't think it was fair. They thought that he was a straight character, a straight guy doing a gay character, and they were too dumb to figure it out and too dumb to listen to the material, yeah. Because we were always very, very, very focused on that the joke wasn't about him being effeminate or gay or anything. It was about his perspective, yeah. Is unique and needs to be heard. That's how we feel. We're so full of it, you know. But quite honestly, that's what it is, right?
We probably wouldn't
drink your Kool-Aid.
Yeah. Making this podcast if we didn't also agree with, yes, with yeah. that, though.
So, that's yeah. nice, kids.
Yeah. I don't know if I have too much more to ask, other than is there anything to look forward to from you and the kids in the hall in the near future? Anything beyond the Amazon reboot?
I would say the Buddy Cole documentary right. is probably going to be, it'll take a couple of years to do, but it's the only thing we have planned right now. You know, Scott's going to keep doing Buddy Cole shows and we'll still keep doing Mouth Congress. And Bruce is now performing all the time, which is great. He's been touring 3 years, his one man show. And I think that's it. It's important that we stay out there. We keep doing stuff and looking for new opportunities to make comedy.
Well, Paul, thank you so much. We've kept you for far, far, far too long. I'm sure there's a search party waiting for you. Scott has probably sent an ambulance loaded up with poppers and liquid cocaine.
I need it.
But before we go, did you have any final words you wanted to offer to us or to our listeners? Anything that we need to know about the man, the legend, Paul Bellini?
You know, I think it's great when people show an interest in the work that we did. And Scott actually made me aware of your podcast. I remember listening and I thought, they're analyzing our work. They're taking it seriously. And I was so flattered.
Aww.
And the stuff I was listening to, like you're going through every sketch and trying to come to terms with how you feel about this stuff. I thought it was fantastic. And so this is a ringing endorsement. Oh, to
that is very nice of you.
I think that this is a great podcast and really important. And thank you for doing it.
I'm not crying. You're crying.
Well, this will be posted all over our social medias. Endorsed by Paul Bellini.
Absolutely. Yeah. Two thumbs up.
Well, on that note, that is all from us this week. So thank you so much, Paul, for joining us. It's been an absolute delight.
Oh, my God.
Thank you. And I promise I'm going to go back to listening to the podcast and catch up on all the episodes that I missed.
Well, when you do, please follow us on social media at Kiff and Tell Pod.
Oh, my God.
And join.
By the time this airs, Twitter, now called X, is probably not going to even exist anymore. So who knows?
But we're consistent.
Who knows where we'll
Kip
be?
And Tell Pod on whatever social media anyone happens to use. And for our loyal listeners, please continue to join us next time when, unfortunately, we won't have Paul, but we will be reviewing every episode of The Kids in the Hall and just wishing we were still talking to our hero Paul. So thanks everyone for listening, and so long.
Bye.
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 Bye. Bye. Bye.